Third among the harpooners was Dagoo, a gigantic coal-black Negro savage with a lion-like tread. Suspended from his ears were two golden hoops, so large that the sailors called them ringbolts and would talk of securing the topsail halyards to them. In his youth, Dagoo had voluntarily shipped on board of a whaler lying in a lonely bay on his native coast, and never having been anywhere in the world but in Africa, Nantucket, and the pagan harbors frequented by whalemen, and having now led for many years the bold life of the fishery in the ships of owners uncommonly heedful of what manner of men they shipped, Dagoo retained all his barbaric virtues, and erect as a giraffe, moved about the decks in all the pomp of 6'5" in his socks. Curious to tell, this imperial negro was the squire of Little Flask, who looked like a chessman beside him. For several days after leaving Nantucket, nothing above hatches was seen of Captain Ahab. The mates regularly relieved each other at the watches, and for aught that could be seen to the contrary, they seemed to be the only commanders of the ship. Only they sometimes issued from the cabin with orders so sudden and peremptory that after all it was plain they but commanded vicariously. Yes, their supreme lord and dictator was there, though hitherto unseen by any eyes not permitted to penetrate into the now sacred retreat of the cabin. Every time I ascended to the deck from my watches below, I instantly gazed aft to mark if any strange face were visible, for my first vague disquietude touching the unknown captain, now in the seclusion of the sea, became almost a perturbation. But whatever it was of apprehensiveness or uneasiness which I felt, yet whenever I came to look about me in the ship, it seemed against all warranty to cherish such emotions. For though the harpooners, with the great body of the crew, were a far more barbaric, heathenish, and motley set than any of the tame merchant ship companies which my previous experiences had made me acquainted with, still I ascribed this to the fierce uniqueness of the nature of that wild vocation in which I had so abandonedly embarked. But it was especially the aspect of the three chief officers of the ship, the mates, which was most forcibly calculated to allay these colorless misgivings and induce confidence and cheerfulness in every presentiment of the voyage. Three better, more likely sea officers and men, each in his own different way, could not readily be found. Now, it being Christmas when the ship shot from outer harbor, for a space we had biting polar weather, though all the time running away from it to the southward, and by every degree and minute of latitude which we sailed, gradually leaving that merciless winter and all its intolerable weather behind us. It was one of those less lowering but still gray and gloomy enough mornings of the transition, when with a fair wind the ship was rushing through the water with a vindictive sort of leaping rapidity, that as I mounted to the deck at the call of the forenoon watch, so soon as I leveled my glance toward the taffrail, foreboding shivers ran over me. Reality outran apprehension. Captain Ahab stood upon his quarterdeck. There seemed no sign of common bodily illness about him, nor of the recovery from any. He looked like a man cut away from the stake when the fire has overrunningly wasted all the limbs without consuming them, or taking away one particle from their compacted, aged robustness. His whole high, broad form seemed made of solid bronze and shaped in an unalterable mold. Threading its way out from among his gray hairs and continuing right down one side of his tawny, scorched face and neck till it disappeared in his clothing, you saw a slender, rod-like mark, lividly whitish. Whether that mark was born with him, or whether it was the scar left by some desperate wound, no one could certainly say. So powerfully did the whole grim aspect of Ahab affect me, that for the first few moments I hardly noted that not a little of this overbearing grimness was owing to the barbaric white leg upon which he partly stood. It had previously come to me that this ivory leg had at sea been fashioned from the polished bone of the sperm whale's jaw. "Aye, he was dismasted off Japan," said the old gay-head Indian once, "but like his dismasted craft, he shipped another mast without coming home for it." I was struck with the singular posture he maintained. Upon each side of the Pequod's quarter-deck, and pretty close to the mizzen shrouds, there was an auger hole, bored about half an inch or so into the plank, his bone leg steadied in that hole. One arm elevated, and holding by a shroud, Captain Ahab stood erect, looking straight out beyond the ship's ever-pitching prow. There was an infinity of firmest fortitude, a determinate, unsurrenderable willfulness in the fixed and fearless forward dedication of that glance. Not a word he spoke, nor did his officers say aught to him, though by all their minutest gestures and expressions they plainly showed the uneasy, if not painful, consciousness of being under a troubled master eye. And not only that, but moody, stricken Ahab stood before them with a crucifixion in his face, in all the nameless, regal, overbearing dignity of some mighty woe. Ere long, from his first visit in the air, he withdrew into his cabin. But after that morning, he was every day visible to the crew, either standing in his pivot hole or seated upon an ivory stool he had, or heavily walking the deck. Concerning the officers of the whale craft, this seems as good a time as any to set down a little domestic peculiarity on shipboard, arising from the existence of the harpooner class of officers, a class unknown, of course, in any other marine than the whale fleet. The large importance attached to the harpooner's vocation is evinced by the fact that originally, in the old Dutch fishery, 2 centuries or more ago, the command of a whale ship was not wholly lodged in the person now called the captain, but was divided between him and an officer called the speksinder. Literally, this word means fat cutter. Usage, however, in time made it equivalent to chief harpooner. In those days, the captain's authority was restricted to the navigation and general management of the vessel. Over the whale-hunting department and all its concerns, the speksinder or chief harpooner reigned supreme. Now, the grand distinction drawn between officer and man at sea is this: the first lives aft, the last forward. Hence, in whale ships and merchantmen alike, the mates have their quarters with the captain, and so too, in most of the American whalers, the harpooners are lodged in the after part of the ship. That is to say, they take their meals in the captain's cabin and sleep in a place indirectly communicating with it. Though the long period of a southern whaling voyage, by far the longest of all voyages now or ever made by men, the peculiar perils of it, and the community of interest prevailing among a company, all of whom, high or low, depend for their profits not upon fixed wages, but upon their common luck, together with their common vigilance, intrepidity, and hard work, though all these things do in some cases tend to beget a less rigorous discipline than in merchantmen generally, yet never mind how much like an old Mesopotamian family these whalemen may, in some primitive instances, live together. For all that, the punctilious externals, at least, of the quarterdeck are seldom materially relaxed, and in no instance done away with. Indeed, many are the Nantucket ships in which you will see the skipper parading his quarterdeck with an elated grandeur not surpassed in any military navy, nay, extorting almost as much outward homage as if he wore the imperial purple and not the shabbiest of pilot cloth. It was during the more pleasant weather that, in due rotation with the other seamen, my first masthead came round. Side 3. The 3 mastheads are kept manned from sunrise to sunset, the seamen taking their regular turns, as at the helm, and relieving each other every 2 hours. In the serene weather of the tropics, it is exceedingly pleasant, the masthead. Nay, to a dreamy, meditative man, it is delightful. There you stand, 100 feet above the silent decks, striding along the deep as if the masts were gigantic stilts, while beneath you and between your legs, as it were, swim the hugest monsters of the sea, even as ships once sailed between the boots of the famous Colossus at Old Rhodes. There you stand, lost in the infinite series of the sea, with nothing ruffled but the waves. The tranced ship indolently rolls, the drowsy trade winds blow, everything resolves you into languor. For the most part, in this tropic whaling life, a sublime uneventfulness invests you. You hear no news, read no gazettes. Extras with startling accounts of commonplaces never delude you into unnecessary excitements. You hear of no domestic afflictions, bankrupt securities, or fall of stocks. You are never troubled with the thought of what you shall have for dinner, for all your meals for 3 years and more are snugly stowed in casks, and your bill of fare is immutable. Concerning all this, it is much to be deplored that the mastheads of a southern whale ship are unprovided with those enviable little tents or pulpits called crow's nests, in which the lookouts of a Greenland whaler are protected from the inclement weather of the frozen seas. In shape, the crow's nest is something like a large tierce or pipe. It is open above, however, where it is furnished with a movable side screen to keep to windward of your head in a hard gale. Being fixed on the summit of the mast, you ascend into it through a little trap hatch in the bottom. On the after side, or side next to the stern of the ship, is a comfortable seat, with a locker underneath for umbrellas, comforters, and coats. In front is a leather rack in which to keep your speaking trumpet, pipe, telescope, and other nautical conveniences. But if we southern whale fishers are not so snugly housed aloft as the Greenland men are, yet that disadvantage is greatly counterbalanced by the widely contrasting serenity of those seductive seas in which we southern fishers mostly float. For one, I used to lounge up the rigging very leisurely, resting in the top to have a chat with Queequeg or anyone else off duty whom I might find there, then ascending a little way further and throwing a lazy leg over the topsail yard, take a preliminary view of the watery pastures, and so at last mount to my ultimate destination. Let me make a clean breast of it here, and frankly admit that I kept but sorry guard. With the problem of the universe revolving in me, how could I, being left completely to myself at such a thought-engendering altitude, how could I but lightly hold my obligations to observe all whale ships' standing orders, keep your weather eye open, and sing out every time? One morning, shortly after breakfast, Ahab, as was his wont, ascended the cabin gangway to the deck. There most sea captains usually walk at that hour, as country gentlemen after the same meal take a few turns in the garden. Soon his steady ivory stride was heard, as to and fro he paced his old rounds, upon planks so familiar to his tread that they were all overdented, like geological stones, with the peculiar mark of his walk. "Do you mark him, Flask?" whispered Stubb. "The chick that's in him pecks the shell. 'Twill soon be out." The hours wore on. Ahab now shut up within his cabin, anon pacing the deck, with the same intense bigotry of purpose in his aspect. It drew near the close of day. Suddenly he came to a halt by the bulwarks, and inserting his bone leg into the auger hole there, and with one hand grasping a shroud, he ordered Starbuck to send everybody aft. "Sir?" said the mate, astonished at an order seldom or never given on shipboard, except in some extraordinary case. "Send everybody aft," repeated Ahab. "Mastheads there, come down." When the entire ship's company were assembled, and with curious and not wholly unapprehensive faces, were eyeing him, for he looked not unlike the weather horizon when a storm is coming up. Ahab, after rapidly glancing over the bulwarks, and then darting his eyes among the crew, started from his standpoint, and as though not a soul were nigh him, resumed his heavy turns upon the deck. With bent head and half-slouched hat, he continued to pace, unmindful of the wondering whispering among the men, till Stubb cautiously whispered to Flask that Ahab must have summoned them there for the purpose of witnessing a pedestrian feat. But this did not last long. Vehemently pausing, he cried, "What do ye do when ye see a whale, men?" "Sing out for him," was the impulsive rejoinder from a score of clubbed voices. "Good!" cried Ahab, with a wild approval in his tones, observing the hearty animation into which his unexpected question had so magnetically thrown them. "And what do ye do next, men?"
"Lower away and after him."
"And what tune is it ye pull to, men? A dead whale or a stove boat?" More and more strangely and fiercely glad and approving grew the countenance of the old man at every shout, while the mariners began to gaze curiously at each other, as if marveling at how it was that they themselves became so excited at such seemingly purposeless questions. But they were all eagerness again as Ahab, now half revolving in his pivot hole, with one hand reaching high up a shroud and tightly, almost convulsively grasping it, addressed them thus.
"All ye mastheaders have before now heard me give orders about a white whale. Look ye, do ye see this Spanish ounce of gold?"
Holding up a broad, bright coin to the sun.
"It is a $16 piece, men, a doubloon. Do ye see it? Mr. Starbuck, hand me yon top maul."
While the mate was getting the hammer, Ahab, without speaking, was slowly rubbing the gold piece against the skirts of his jacket, as if to heighten its luster. Receiving the top maul from Starbuck, he advanced towards the mainmast with the hammer uplifted in one hand, exhibiting the gold with the other, and with a high raised voice exclaiming,
"Whosoever of ye raises me a white-headed whale with a wrinkled brow and a crooked jaw, whosoever of ye raises me that white-headed whale with three holes punctured in his starboard fluke, look ye, whosoever of ye raises me that same white whale, he shall have this gold ounce, my boys."
"Huzzah! Huzzah!" cried the seamen, as with swinging tarpaulins they hailed the act of nailing the gold to the mast.
"It is a white whale, I say,"
resumed Ahab, as he threw down the top maul.
"A white whale! Skin your eyes for him, men. Look sharp for white water. If you see but a bubble, sing out."
All this while, Tashtego, Dagoo, and Queequeg had looked on with even more intense interest and surprise than the rest. And at the mention of the wrinkled brow and crooked jaw, they had started as if each was separately touched by some specific recollection.
"Captain Ahab," said Tashtego, "that white whale must be the same that some call Moby Dick."
"Moby Dick!" shouted Ahab. "Do ye know the white whale, then, Tash?"
"Does he fantail a little curious, sir, before he goes down?" said the gay-header deliberately.
"And has he a curious spout, too?" said Dagoo. "Very bushy, even for a Parmacetti, and mighty quick, Captain Ahab."
"And he have one, two, three, oh, good many iron in him hide, too, Captain," cried Queequeg disjointedly. "All twisky tibby twisk like him,
faltering hard for a word and screwing his hand round and round as though uncorking a bottle.
"Like him, corkscrew," cried Ahab. "Aye, Queequeg, the harpoons lie all twisted and wrenched in him. Aye, Dagoo, his spout is a big one, like a whole shock of wheat and white as a pile of our Nantucket wool after the great annual sheep shearing. Aye, Tashtego, and he fantails like a split jib in a squall. Death and devil's men, it is Moby Dick ye have seen. Moby Dick!"
"Captain Ahab," said Starbuck, who with Stubb and Flask had thus far been eyeing his superior with increasing surprise, but at last seemed struck with a thought which somewhat explained all the wonder. "Captain Ahab, I have heard of Moby Dick.
But what I would ask is, was it Moby Dick that took off thy leg?
Aye, Starbuck, cried Ahab. Aye, my hearties all round. It was Moby Dick that dismasted me. Moby Dick that brought me to this dead stump I stand on now. Aye, aye, he shouted with a terrific, loud animal sob, like that of a heart-stricken moose. It was that accursed whale that raised me, made me a poor pegging lubber forever and a day.
Then tossing both arms with measureless imprecations, he shouted out,
Aye, aye, and I'll chase him round Good Hope, and round the Horn, and round the Norway Maelstrom, and round Perdition's flames before I give him up. And this is what ye have shipped for, men, to chase that white whale on both sides of land and over all sides of earth, till he spouts black blood and rolls fins out. What say ye, men? Will ye splice hands on it now?
Aye, aye, shouted the harpooners and seamen, running closer to the excited old man. A sharp eye for the white whale, a sharp lance for Moby Dick.
God bless ye.
He seemed to half sob and half shout.
God bless ye, men! Steward, go draw the great measure of grog. But what's this long face about, Mr. Starbuck? Wilt thou not chase the white whale? Art not game for Moby Dick?
I am game for his crooked jaw and for the jaws of death, too, Captain Ahab, if it fairly comes in the way of the business we follow. But I came here to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance. How many barrels will thy vengeance yield thee, even if thou gettest it? It will not fetch thee much in our Nantucket market.
Nantucket market! Come closer, Starbuck. Thou requirest a little lower layer. If money's to be the measurer, man, and the accountants have computed the great counting house, the Globe, by girdling it with guineas, one to every 3 parts of an inch, then let me tell thee that my vengeance will fetch a great premium. Here!
He smites his chest, whispered Stubb. Vengeance on a dumb brute, cried Starbuck, that simply smote thee from blindest instinct? Madness! To be enraged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous.
Hark ye yet again, and a little lower layer. All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed, there, some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth the molding of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike, strike through the mask.
How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall?
To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me. He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength, with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. And be the white whale agent, or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. For could the sun do that, then could I do the other, since there is ever a sort of fair play herein, jealousy presiding over all creations. But not my master, man, is even that fair play. Who's over me? Truth has no confines. Take off thine eye. More intolerable than fiends' glarings is a doltish stare. So thou reddenest and palest. My heat has melted thee to anger glow. But look ye, Starbuck, what is said in heat, that thing unsays itself. There are men from whom warm words are small indignity. I meant not to incense thee. Let it go. The crew, man, the crew! Are they not one and all with Ahab in this matter of the whale? See, Stubb, he laughs. See yonder Chilean, he snorts to think of it. Stand up amid the general hurricane, thy one tossed sapling cannot, Starbuck. And what is it? Reckon it. 'Tis but to help strike a fin, no wondrous feat for Starbuck. What is it more? From this one poor hunt, then, the best lance out of all Nantucket, surely he will not hang back when every foremast hand has clutched a whetstone. Ah, constraining seize thee, I see. Speak, but speak. Aye, aye, thy silence, then, that voices thee. Starbuck now is mine, cannot oppose me now without rebellion.
God keep us all, murmured Starbuck lowly. The measure! The measure! Cried Ahab. Receiving the brimming pewter, and turning to the harpooneers, he ordered them to produce their weapons. Then ranging them before him near the capstan, with their harpoons in their hands, while his three mates stood at his side with their lances, and the rest of the ship's company formed a circle round the group, he stood for an instant searchingly eyeing every man of his crew. But those wild eyes met his, as the bloodshot eyes of the prairie wolves meet the eye of their leader ere he rushes on at their head in the trail of the bison.
Drink and pass, he cried,
handing the heavy charged flagon to the nearest seaman.
Round with it, round, short draughts, long swallows, men. 'Tis hot as Satan's hoof, it spiralizes in ye. Attend now, my braves, I have mustered ye all round this capstan, and ye mates, flank me with your lances, and ye harpooneers, stand there with your irons, and ye stout mariners, ring me in, that I may in some sort revive a noble custom of my fisherman fathers before me.
As they crowded round the captain, Ahab cried,
Ye mates, I do appoint ye three cup-bearers to my three pagan kinsmen there, yon three most honorable gentlemen and noblemen, my valiant harpooneers. Cut your seizings and draw the poles, ye harpooneers.
Silently obeying the order, the three harpooneers now stood with the detached iron part of their harpoons, some 3 feet long, held, barbs up, before them.
Stab me not with that keen steel. Cant them over. Know ye not the goblet end? Turn up the socket. So, so, now ye cupbearers advance. The irons, take them. Hold them while I fill.
Forthwith, slowly going from one officer to the other, he brimmed the harpoon sockets with the fiery waters from the pewter.
Now, three to three ye stand. Commend the murderous chalices. Ye who are now made parties to this indissoluble league. Ha, Starbuck, but the deed is done. Drink, ye harpooneers, drink and swear, ye men that man the deathful whaleboat's bow. Death to Moby Dick! God hunt us all if we do not hunt Moby Dick to his death!
The long, barbed steel goblets were lifted, and to cries and maledictions against the white whale, the spirits were simultaneously quaffed down with a hiss. Starbuck paled, and turned, and shivered. Once more, and finally, the replenished pewter went the rounds among the frantic crew. When waving his free hand to them, Ahab retired within his cabin, and they all dispersed. Ishmael was one of that crew. My shouts had gone up with the rest. My oath had been welded with theirs. A wild, mystical, sympathetical feeling was in me. Ahab's quenchless feud seemed mine. With greedy ears, I learned the history of that murderous monster against whom I and all the others had taken our oaths of violence and revenge. For some time past, the unaccompanied, secluded white whale had haunted those uncivilized seas most frequented by the sperm whale fishermen. But not all of them knew of his existence. Only a few of them, comparatively, had knowingly seen him, while the number who as yet had actually and knowingly given battle to him was small indeed. For owing to the large number of whale cruisers, the disorderly way they were sprinkled over the entire watery circumference, so as seldom or never for a whole 12 months or more on a stretch to encounter a single news-telling sail of any sort, all these circumstances long obstructed the spread through the whole worldwide whaling fleet of the special individualizing tidings concerning Moby Dick. And as for those who, previously hearing of the white whale, by chance caught sight of him, in the beginning of the thing, they had every one of them almost as boldly and fearlessly lowered for him,
as for any other whale of that species. But at length such calamities did ensue in these assaults, not restricted to sprained wrists and ankles, broken limbs, or devouring amputations, but fatal to the last degree of fatality, those repeated disastrous repulses, all accumulating and piling their terrors upon Moby Dick. Those things had gone far to shake the fortitude of so many brave hunters to whom the story of the white whale had eventually come. Nor did wild rumors of all sorts fail to exaggerate, and still the more horrify the true histories of these deadly encounters. For not only do fabulous rumors naturally grow out of the very body of all surprising terrible events, but in maritime life, far more than in that of terra firma, wild rumors abound, wherever there is any adequate reality for them to cling to. And as the sea surpasses the land in this matter, so the whale fishery surpasses every other sort of maritime life in the wonderfulness and fearfulness of the rumors which sometimes circulate there. No wonder, then, that the outblown rumors of the white whale did in the end incorporate with themselves all manner of morbid hints and half-formed suggestions of supernatural agencies, which eventually invested Moby Dick with new terrors unborrowed from anything that visibly appears. So that in many cases such a panic did he finally strike that few who had heard of the great white whale were willing to encounter the perils of his jaw. Some of them, indeed, declared that Moby Dick was not only ubiquitous, but immortal, that though groves of spears should be planted in his flanks, he would still swim away unharmed. But even stripped of these supernatural surmisings, there was enough in the earthly make and incontestable character of the monster to strike the imagination with unwonted power. For it was not so much his uncommon bulk that so much distinguished him from other sperm whales, but his peculiar snow-white wrinkled forehead and a high pyramidical white hump. These were his prominent features, the tokens whereby, even in the limitless, uncharted seas, he revealed his identity at a long distance to those who knew him. Nor was it his unwonted magnitude, nor his remarkable hue, nor yet his deformed lower jaw that so much invested the whale with natural terror, as that unexampled, intelligent malignity, which, according to specific accounts, he had over and over again evinced in his assaults. More than all, his treacherous retreats struck more of dismay than perhaps aught else, for when swimming before his exulting pursuers, with every apparent symptom of alarm, he had several times been known to turn round suddenly, and bearing down upon them, either stave their boats to splinters or drive them back in consternation to their ship. His three boats stove around him, and oars and men both whirling in the eddies. One captain, seizing the line knife from his broken prow, had dashed at the whale, blindly seeking with a 6-inch blade to reach the fathom-deep life of the Leviathan. That captain was Ahab. And then it was that suddenly sweeping his sickle-shaped lower jaw beneath him, Moby Dick had reaped away Ahab's leg. Ever since that encounter, Ahab had cherished a wild vindictiveness against the whale. He at last came to identify with him not only all his bodily woes, but all his intellectual and spiritual exasperations. The white whale swam before him as the monomaniac incarnation of all those malicious agencies which some deep men feel eating in them till they are left living on with half a heart and half a lung. Here then was this ungodly old man, chasing with curses a Job's whale round the world, at the head of a crew, too, chiefly made up of mongrel renegades and castaways and cannibals. How it was that they so responded to the old man's ire would be to dive deeper than Ishmael can go. It was the middle watch, a fair moonlight. The seamen were standing in a cordon, extending from one of the freshwater butts in the waist to the scuttlebutt near the taffrail. In this manner, they passed the buckets to fill the scuttlebutt. From hand to hand, the buckets went in the deepest silence, only broken by the occasional flap of a sail and the steady hum of the unceasingly advancing keel. It was in the midst of this repose that Archie, one of the cordon, whose post was near the after hatches, whispered to his neighbor,
"Hist! Did you hear that noise, Cabaco?" "Take the bucket, will you, Archie? What noise do you mean?" "There it is again, under the hatches. Don't you hear it? A cough. It sounded like a cough." "Cough be damned. Pass along that return bucket." "There again, there it is. It sounds like two or three sleepers turning over."
"Caramba, have done, shipmate, will ye? It's the three soaked biscuits ye ate for supper turning over inside of ye, nothing else. Look to the bucket."
"Say what ye will, shipmate. I've sharp ears."
"Aye, you are the chap, ain't ye, that heard the hum of the old Quakeress's knitting needles 50 miles at sea from Nantucket? You're the chap."
"Grin away. We'll see what turns up. Hark ye, Cabaco, there is somebody down in the afterhold that has not yet been seen on deck, and I suspect our old mogul knows something of it, too. I heard Stubb tell Flask one morning watch that there was something of that sort in the wind." "Tish! The bucket!"
Had you followed Captain Ahab down into his cabin after the squall that took place on the night succeeding that wild ratification of his purpose with the crew, you would have seen him go to a locker in the transom, bringing out a large wrinkled roll of yellowish sea charts, spread them before him on his screwed-down table. Then, seating himself before it, you would have seen him intently study the various lines and shadings which there met his eye, and with slow but steady pencil trace additional courses over spaces that before were blank. At intervals, he would refer to piles of old logbooks beside him, wherein were set down the seasons and places in which, on various former voyages of various ships, sperm whales had been captured or seen. While thus employed, the heavy pewter lamp suspended in chains over his head continually rocked with the motion of the ship, and forever threw shifting beams and shadows of lines upon his wrinkled brow, till it almost seemed that while he himself was marking out lines and courses on the wrinkled charts, some invisible pencil was also tracing lines and courses upon the deeply marked chart of his forehead. With the charts of all four oceans before him, Ahab was threading a maze of currents and eddies, with a view to the more certain accomplishment of that monomaniac thought of his soul. Now, to anyone not fully acquainted with the ways of the Leviathans, it might seem an absurdly hopeless task thus to seek out one solitary creature in the unhooped oceans of this planet. But not so did it seem to Ahab, who knew the sets of all the tides and currents, and thereby calculating the driftings of the sperm whale's food, and also calling to mind the regular, ascertained seasons for hunting him in particular latitudes, could arrive at a reasonable surmise, almost approaching to certainty, concerning the timeliest day to be upon this or that ground in search of his prey. And hence not only at substantiated times, upon well-known separate feeding grounds, could Ahab hope to encounter his prey, but in crossing the widest expanses of water between those grounds, he could, by his art, so place and time himself on his way, as even then not to be wholly without prospect of a meeting. It was a cloudy, sultry afternoon. The seamen were lazily lounging about the decks, or vacantly gazing over into the lead-colored waters. Queequeg and I were mildly employed weaving what is called a sword mat, for an additional lashing to our boat. So still and subdued, and yet somehow preluding, was all the scene, and such an incantation of reverie lurked in the air that each silent sailor seemed resolved into his own invisible self. Thus we were weaving and weaving away, when I started at a sound so strange, long-drawn, and musically wild and unearthly, that I stood gazing up at the clouds whence that voice dropped like a wing. High aloft in the cross-trees was that mad gay-header Tashtego. His body was reaching eagerly forward, his hand stretched out like a wand, and at brief, sudden intervals, he continued his cries. As he stood hovering over us, half suspended in the air, so wildly and eagerly peering towards the horizon, you would have thought him some prophet or seer beholding the shadows of fate, and by those wild cries announcing their coming.
"There she blows! There she blows!"
"Where away?" Starbuck shouted back.
"On the lee beam, about 2 miles off, a school of them."
Instantly, all was commotion. The sperm whale blows as a clock ticks, with the same undeviating and reliable uniformity, and thereby whalemen distinguish this fish from other tribes of his genus.
"There go flukes!"
was now the cry from Teshtigo, and the whales disappeared. The ship was now kept away from the wind, and she went gently rolling before it. Teshtigo reporting that the whales had gone down, heading to leeward, we confidently looked to see them again directly in advance of our bows. For that singular craft, at times evinced by the sperm whale when, sounding with his head in one direction, he nevertheless, while concealed beneath the surface, mills round and swiftly swims off in the opposite quarter, this deceitfulness of his could not now be in action, for there was no reason to suppose that the fish seen by Teshtigo had been in any way alarmed, or indeed knew at all of our vicinity. One of the men selected for shipkeepers, that is, those not appointed to the boats, by this time relieved the Indian at the main masthead. The sailors at the fore and mizzen had come down. The line tubs were fixed in their places, the cranes were thrust out, the mainyard was backed, and the three boats swung over the sea like 3 samphire baskets over high cliffs. Outside of the bulwarks, their eager crews with one hand clung to the rail, while one foot was expectantly poised on the gunwale. But at this critical instant, a sudden exclamation was heard that took every eye from the whale. With a start, all glared at Dark Ahab, who was surrounded by 5 dusky phantoms that seemed fresh formed out of air. The phantoms, for so they then seemed, were flitting on the other side of the deck, and with a noiseless celerity were casting loose the tackles and bands of the boat which swung there. This boat had always been deemed one of the spare boats, though technically called the captain's, on account of its hanging from the starboard quarter. The figure that now stood by its bows was tall and swart, with 1 white tooth evilly protruding from its steel-like lips. A rumpled Chinese jacket of black cotton funereally invested him, with wide black trousers of the same dark stuff. But strangely crowning this ebonness was a glistening white plaited turban, the living hair braided and coiled round and round upon his head. Less swart in aspect, the companions of this figure were of that vivid, tiger-yellow complexion peculiar to some of the aboriginal natives of the Manilas. While yet the wondering ship's company were gazing upon these strangers, Ahab cried out to the white-turbaned old man at their head,
"All ready there, Fedallah?"
"Ready," was the half-hissed reply.
"Lower away, then, d'ye hear?" shouted Ahab across the deck. "Lower away there, I say!"
Such was the thunder of his voice that, spite of their amazement, the men sprang over the rail. The sheaves whirled round in the blocks. With a wallow, the 3 boats dropped into the sea, while with a dexterous, offhand daring, unknown in any other vocation, the sailors, goat-like, leaped down the rolling ship's sides into the tossing boats below. Hardly had they pulled out from under the ship's lee when a 4th keel, coming from the windward side, pulled round under the stern and showed the 5 strangers rowing Ahab, who, standing erect in the stern, loudly hailed Starbuck, Stubb, and Flask to spread themselves widely so as to cover a large expanse of water. But with all their eyes again riveted upon the swart Fedallah and his crew, the inmates of the other boats obeyed not the command.
"Captain Ahab," said Starbuck.
"Spread yourselves," cried Ahab. "Give way, all 4 boats. Thou, Flask, pull more out to leeward."
"Aye, aye, sir," cheerily cried little Kingpost, sweeping round his great steering oar. "Lay back," he shouted to his crew. "There she blows, right ahead, boys. Lay back. Never heed yon yellow boys, Archie."
"Oh, I don't mind 'em, sir," said Archie. "I knew it all before now. Didn't I hear 'em in the hold? And didn't I tell Cabaco here of it? They are stowaways, Mr. Flask."
"Pull, pull, my fine hearts," cried Stubb to his crew, some of whom still showed signs of uneasiness. "Pull, my little ones. What is it you stare at? Those chaps in yonder boat? Tut, they are only 5 more hands come to help us, never mind from where. The more the merrier. Pull, then. That's it, long and strong.
In obedience to a sign from Ahab, Starbuck was now pulling obliquely across Stubb's bow, and when for a minute or so the two boats were pretty near to each other, Stubb hailed the mate.
Mr. Starbuck, a word with ye, sir, if you please.
Halloa,
returned Starbuck, turning round not a single inch as he spoke, still earnestly but whisperingly urging his crew, his face set like a flint from Stubbs.
What do you think of those yellow boys, sir?
Smuggled on board somehow before the ship sailed. A sad business, Mr. Stubb, but never mind, all for the best. Let all your crew pull strong, come what will. There's hogsheads of sperm ahead, Mr. Stubb, and that's what ye came for. This, at least, is duty. Duty and profit, hand in hand.
Aye, I thought as much, soliloquized Stubb, when the boats diverged. As soon as I clapped eye on him, I thought so. Aye, and that's what he went into the afterhold for so often. They were hidden down there. The white whale's at the bottom of it. Well, so be it. Can't be helped. All right, give way, men. It ain't the white whale today. Give way.
Now, the advent of these outlandish strangers at such a critical instant as the lowering of the boats from the deck had not unreasonably awakened a sort of superstitious amazement in some of the ship's company. But Archie's fancied discovery having some time previous got abroad among them, though indeed not credited then, this had in some small measure prepared them for the event. It took off the extreme edge of their wonder. And so what with all this and Stubbs' confident way of accounting for their appearance, they were for the time freed from superstitious surmisings. Though the affair still left abundant room for all manner of wild conjectures as to Dark Ahab's precise agency in the matter from the beginning. Meantime, Ahab, out of hearing of his officers, having sighted the furthest to windward, was still ranging ahead of the other boats, a circumstance bespeaking how potent a crew was pulling him. Those tiger-yellow creatures of his seemed all steel and whalebone. Like 5 trip-hammers, they rose and fell with regular strokes of strength, which periodically started the boat along the water like a horizontal burst boiler out of a Mississippi steamer. As for Fedala, who was seen pulling the harpooner oar, he had thrown aside his black jacket and displayed his naked chest with the whole part of his body above the gunwale, clearly cut against the alternating depressions of the watery horizon. While at the other end of the boat, Ahab, with one arm like a fencer's thrown half backward into the air as if to counterbalance any tendency to trip, was seen steadily managing his steering oar as in 1,000 boat lowerings ere the white whale had torn him. All at once the outstretched arm gave a peculiar motion and then remained fixed, while the boat's 5 oars were seen simultaneously peaked. Instantly, the 3 spread boats in the rear paused on their way. The whales had irregularly settled bodily down into the blue, thus giving no distantly discernible token of the movement, though from his closer vicinity Ahab had observed it.
"Every man look out along his oar," cried Starbuck. "Thou, Queequeg, stand up!"
Nimbly springing up on the triangular raised box in the bow, the savage stood erect there, and with intensely eager eyes gazed off towards the spot where the chase had last been descried. Likewise, upon the extreme stern of the boat, where it was also triangularly platformed level with the gunwale, Starbuck himself was seen coolly and adroitly balancing himself to the jerking tossings of his chip of a craft, and silently eyeing the vast blue eye of the sea. Not very far distant, Flask's boat was also lying breathlessly still. Meanwhile, Stubb, the third mate, betrayed no such far-gazing solicitudes. The whales might have made one of their regular soundings, not a temporary dive from mere fright, and if that were the case, Stubb, as his wont in such cases, it seems was resolved to solace the languishing interval with his pipe. He withdrew it from his hatband, where he always wore it aslant like a feather. He loaded it and rammed home the loading with his thumb end. But hardly had he ignited his match across the rough sandpaper of his hand when Tashtego, whose eyes had been setting to windward like 2 fixed stars, suddenly dropped like light from his erect attitude to his seat, crying out in a quick frenzy of hurry,
"Down, down all and give way! There they are!"
To a landsman, no whale or any sign of a herring would have been visible at that moment. Nothing but a troubled bit of greenish-white water, and thin, scattered puffs of vapor hovering over it, and suffusingly blowing off to leeward like the confused scud from white rolling billows. The air around suddenly vibrated and tingled, as it were, like the air over intensely heated plates of iron. Beneath this atmospheric waving and curling, and partially beneath a thin layer of water, the whales were swimming. Seen in advance of all the other indications, the puffs of vapor they spouted seemed the forerunning couriers and detached flying outriders. All four boats were now in keen pursuit of that one spot of troubled water and air. But it bade fair to outstrip them. It flew on and on, as a mass of interblending bubbles borne down a rapid stream from the hills.
"Pull, pull, my good boys," said Starbuck, in the lowest possible but intensest concentrated whisper to his men.
It was a sight full of quick wonder and awe. The vast swells of the omnipotent sea, the surging, hollow roar they made as they rolled along the eight gunwales, like gigantic bowls in a boundless bowling green, the brief, suspended agony of the boat as it would tip for an instant on the knife edge of the sharper waves that almost seemed threatening to cut it in two, the sudden profound dip into the watery glens and hollows, the keen spurrings and goadings to gain the top of the opposite hill, the headlong sled-like slide down its other side, all these, with the cries of the headsmen and harpooners, and the shuddering gasps of the oarsmen, with the wondrous sight of the ivory Pequod bearing down upon